From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
We may know one when we see it, but what word best describes an ecological landscape? Compared to traditional, more formal gardens, such native plant forward designs are variously labeled as looser or naturalistic or wildish, all perfectly accurate. Is there perhaps a word, though, that really gets at both the visual and functional aspects that these beautiful biodiversity-supporting plantings embody, a word that can help us set the intention for the plants we choose and where we place them? Abundant is the descriptor of choice and a primary design goal for today's guest, landscape designer Kelly Norris. So more in a moment from him about creating abundance. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support for Away to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Kelly Norris, the former director of horticulture and education at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden for 8 years, is founder of the Public Horticulture Company, a Des Moines-based ecological landscape firm. His motto is just keep planting, which indeed adds up to abundance if we follow some general guidelines on what key players we make room for. I'm glad to welcome him to the show today. Hi, Kelly, how are you?
Hi, Margaret. It's great to be with you.
Spring madness continuing out there?
Spring madness. It has been a robust spring. We're looking forward to the short rows, as they say in corn country, of what we've got left to do here for spring planting.
Okay. Before we get started, I want to say we'll have a book giveaway of your book with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com.
Great.
And so I wanted to just talk about some of the things we talked about. We did a really interesting New York Times column together not long ago, and it was about abundance, and people just, you know, I think they really enjoyed it. You know, the idea of having this word in mind as they were puzzling their way through to a design, working with native plants and so forth. And so, you know, when you talk about abundance, you don't mean, hey, let's plant 100 or 1,000 of something simply to make a visual or aesthetic impression. You have more in mind than that, yes?
That's right. You know, the concept of abundance in ecology is a notion about the number of individuals of a single species in a population somewhere in the wild. Okay. And so, you know, the term abundant obviously has a lot of rhetorical and colloquial meanings just in our kind of daily lives and conversation. But in ecological terms, it's kind of a specific thing. It's a comparison of volume, right? Of more versus less. And you know, an observation around, you know, so why do some species occur so abundantly in comparison to others that might be much less frequent? And so that concept and that notion is something we work with a lot in practice that has not only, as you articulate, obvious aesthetic implications, but also has, you know, very valuable ecological ones as well.
So a plant might not just look beautiful, but it might call in the important creatures saying, hey, you know, I'm here. Are you hungry? Are you thirsty? do you want some pollen? Do you want some nectar? Do you want to use it as host plant, right? It could be all these things or some of these things.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think the thing, you know, anybody who's spent some time in a more naturalistic garden or has been, you know, exploring these kinds of gardening and design techniques for a while now comes to realize is that, of course, you know, plants aren't integers. They're not out there just by themselves as lonely things, looking good for our benefit. They're active participants in the world around them. And so, that becomes part of the way in which we begin to understand abundance, is to understand that it's not totally happenstance, that there's obviously some connections. There's a sort of in the notion of complex systems theory, there's ultimately many threads that one could pull as you're trying to investigate, well, why is Penstemon digitalis right now in the peak of prairie spring just everywhere in a wet prairie or a wet ditch or something like that? Like, why is that? Why is that species? And
Right.
there's lots of threads there, right? Part of it's sociality, it's behavior, it's kind of life history. Penstemon aren't really the longest lived plants in the world, so they tend to produce lots of seed in a single generation, and thus, their populations kind of ebb and flow in this way too. But they're also a very critical resource for a great number of bees this time of year, as well as, of course, hummingbirds. And so there's kind of a confluence of these factors that begin to, I don't want to say diagnose, but I'll say for the purpose of conversation, kind of begin to diagnose why that might be the case, that we see a species like Penstemon digitalis, low-hanging fruit this time of year, being so abundant. And so if we take that idea and start to use that in a garden setting, then we just sort of take those benefits and kind of scale those to the setting of a garden. We can see some of those results pretty close to home.
So it is, sometimes it's easy to kind of guess at what'll be a visually impactful potential choice, a plant that's showy, if I put a lot of those, it's really going to look great here, that kind of thing. And that might be the easier part of the equation. But how do you, I mean, you just made the observation about the Penstemon, which is something that's part of your landscape there. How do people, where are some of the places that people can kind of learn about what are these abundant, I think the word we used in the time story, you talked about them being charismatic, kind of players of each season or whatever. It seems like it's not enough to say, oh, that'll be pretty, that'll be pretty. We want to go deeper. So a source or two that you think about for
One of the things we're kind of dancing around here, and what we can just say it now, is that some of these species are, this isn't a pattern, for instance, that's unique to just one or a few places. Something like, Rebecca herda, an annual or biennial or short-lived perennial species that we talked about in the time story,
the
is a great.
black-eyed Susan, as we call it,
That's
yeah.
right. That's right. Is a pretty, common plant throughout much of North America. And so
Right.
look at how Rudbeckia herda kind of operates out there in the world. It's not hard to sort of see that, like, oh, okay, well, plants that kind of occur everywhere, the everywhere plants, the generalists, more than likely, carrying alongside the odds that they're going to be rather useful to a great number of creatures. Hence, one of the reasons why they might be rather abundant is because their pollination biology is sort of favoring, that kind of continuity year to year, decade to decade, eon after eon, across such a large geographic area like North America, for instance. And so, kind of looking for those generalist species, on lists. The Xerces Society has some great list of kind of keystone species. National Wildlife Federation has these too. And keystone species aren't always exactly generalists. Keystones are kind of, that's looking at kind of natural function through a somewhat different lens. But oftentimes, keystone species are kind of understood often at the generic level. Doug Tallamy's work about oaks, brings them to mind
Right,
first and foremost.
right.
But unless you're in a forest, an oak isn't necessarily always an abundant species, in
Right.
any given ecological system. There's all kinds of oaks all over the place. But remember, just for people listening, abundance is a measurement at a single species level of number of individuals. There's several concepts here we can start to kind of, investigate and look from to start to develop a list for ourselves as gardeners to say, well, in my part of the world, wherever that's at, if I'm out here on the prairie or, if you're on the East Coast or something, how do you start to kind of, ferret out, well, what are those most common and likely and abundant species I might find in any given kind of ecological condition? So those lists are a place to start that adventure.
Right, and in the Xerces, I think they even have the ones that are, they have those regional lists of pollinator-friendly plants. I'll give the links to these various sources with the transcript of the show over on
Yeah,
awaytogarden.com
great.
as well. And it is really helpful. And like you say, generalists, plants that serve a lot of customers. And
Yeah.
because if you do good by a lot of different insect species, they do good by you
They
over
do good by
the
you, that's right.
millennia, over the millions of years, and you become widespread and they are supported in numbers, their populations are supported. It's a one hand washes the other kind of thing over time, right?
Exactly. And there's kind of this notion in, you could call it nature's Pareto principle. I think we refer to it, that 80-20 rule, right?
Right.
Also familiar with in business and management, all this stuff we hear about that, there's kind of 20% that's doing 20% of the species out there in the natural world are doing like 80% of the ecosystem function. Those numbers are somewhat relative, but the point is that, most species, full stop, are not abundant. So most species that even you could imagine in your garden, in their wild homes, wherever they're from, are often not that abundant. They might be uncommon to common, or even infrequent, or as even rare in some instances. Oftentimes, a lot of plants that are quite rare in the wild end up becoming very popular garden plants for obvious sort of aesthetic or ornamental reasons, perhaps. So actually, when you think about it, really this idea about frequency isn't a trait that's held by many, many, many species in the grand scheme of the world. It's oftentimes these very kind of charismatic generalist species that have, it's not, they're not always, they don't fit a particular profile always either, except that they have some relationship to their place and the ecosystem sort of services and functions of a place that lead them to be abundant in comparison to others. And so that is one way to think about it, is like there's this kind of 80-20 rule. Like there's just a handful of species out there that are kind of carrying all the water, so to speak, in the tall grass prairie kind of mindset. I find that a lot of people are often very surprised to learn that historically, the prairie was largely grass. I mean, the kind of this wonderful palette of prairie flowers, broadly speaking, that have entered the horticultural lexicon in the last, 25 or 30 years, kind of just smacks it. It's like, what do you mean? Where were they at? Well, they were associated oftentimes with episodes of disturbance, or certain conditions, stressful conditions, or soil typologies that led to, a more likely density of forbs. But by and large, prairies and the central grassland systems across North America were largely dominated by two, three, four species of grasses. Hence again, that 80-20 rule of like just at like four species were accounting for, 80%+ of the biomass of a third of the continent at one point in time, in round numbers. So.
I mean, I think about, and I think what you're saying is partly that in each season there's, like, you again use that Penstemon example currently and so forth where you are, and I think there's kind of a star of each season or stars of each season and so forth. And I mean, I think of fall especially, and here where I am in the northeast, and in a lot of places actually different species but still within the same genera, the asters and the goldenrods. I
Yes,
mean,
yes.
the work that those plants do and the beauty that they provide as well, it's just, that those are powerhouses. You know that those are important players.
Right. And you mentioned two great examples there, both of which happen to be in the same family. I mean, the Asteraceae as a family is probably, leading the pack by more than a little in terms of genera and species that are more than likely to be, abundant sometimes. I mean, it's hard to kind of go anywhere in North America at a certain point in the autumn, relatively speaking, wherever that's at, and not find a charismatic Asteraceae at some point. Be an annual, be a perennial, whatever,
And speaking of general, I mean, their flowers, the way they're built, so to speak, they're accessible. You don't have to have a special tongue or shape. You don't have to be an insect with a special body or tongue shape. You can be a lot of different shapes and sizes and structures, and still take, sustenance from a member of the aster family, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool, there. That's it. Kind of all makes sense, is what I'm saying, in very non-scientific terms.
Yeah, no, and I think that so as a designer, the one th or as a gardener at home, I mean, one of the things that you could start to derive from that insight is to say, okay, if I'm planning a new planting, and I'm thinking, about all these species I want to grow, and I mean, I've got a list of 50 species we're going to try to get into this design. Okay, well, all of those can't be everywhere all at once, despite the name of a great movie. But so if you think about season to season, well, what are my two or three charismatic players in that, early spring window, and then that kind of summer solstice window, and then that kind of late summer, and then the fall. And so you can almost start to build a design process, as we do, around these kind of anchors in any particular season that become, the abundant players, the nodes of the both aesthetic and ecological concept of what you're trying to do. And so, sometimes for us, it kind of becomes a template. I mean, it's not a formula, but there is a sort of scaffold that we can apply to our design process to say, as we're tooling along, thinking about all these plants, okay, well, but who's going to carry the banner here on spring, summer, fall?
But that's not all you think about. And I was very interested to learn when we did the time story, and also in your book, Your Natural Garden. The book is called Your Natural Garden. I was very interested to sort of learn about the way you think about the layers of the landscape. And even though these abundant players, these sort of stars of each season, are in your mind, you start with some of the other layers, because if we don't have them, just like your example before about the prairie being built of, having grasses being such an important component, if we don't have some of these other players, we don't have a landscape. We just have a big mess. So can we talk a little bit about, because you talked to me about matrix and so forth, the different parts of, and that's a word we hear a lot since we've been hearing more about ecological design. We hear about matrix. And so tell me about what layers of the landscape do you think about besides these stars of each season?
We've been using a three-part typology for years now. I mean, back in my botanical garden days, we kind of hatched onto this somewhat oversimplified way of thinking about kind of any natural landscape in a way. I mean, there's various languages, different designers and schools of thought have kind of, different architectures of words for the same ideas. But, in our work, we think about matrix structure and vignettes. And matrix is for us a layer of the landscape that's often, equated to being green mulch. It's plants that are kind of low in profile and tend to form, fairly a social fabric over the space that we're working in. The structural layer is usually a woody or emergent perennial character. It's something that's generally paying the rent more than once, as the phrase goes. It's persistent throughout the growing season. It becomes a scaffold, for the rest of the planting. And then, finally, so we have the floor and the walls here of the house, and the interior becomes kind of the vignettes as that kind of seasonal cadence that moves through the whole growing season. And so it's within that layer that we're probably talking about abundance in the way we're talking about it from a maybe a floral bias, where we're most concerned about that and saying, what resources are we providing for, the ecological network that every planting, every garden is already a part of. And so, those kind of seasonal anchors, those key charismatic species become, kind of a subset of that vignettes layer. Now, obviously, back to the matrix for a minute, those are generally fairly abundant players too. They're not often necessarily species that end up having lots of immediate floral resource value, because they often tend to be, they might be graminoids, carex grasses, et cetera. That not always, certainly, but they have other roles to play ecologically. But when we think about, abundance, I think there's kind of there's a little bit of a floral bias to, I think, our conversation today, inherent to what we're talking about, because we're trying to we're trying to do something that's also showy and aesthetic, but also, something that's feeding creatures out there in the world.
Well, and that's why I wanted to sort of double back to that, especially the matrix part, because as I said, first of all, we hear and I hear and read more about that word since we've been, talking, working more in native plants and ecological or ecologically focused designs and so forth. I hear people talk about it, but it's easy to get distracted as a gardener when shopping the nursery or the catalogs, especially online, and go for all the showiest stuff and forget to that we need to make a substantial investment in that, as you say, green mulch. I mean, the designer Claudia West said to me years ago, she's from Phyto Design, she said to me, plants are the mulch, and you know what I mean? Not stuff in bags, Margaret.
That's right.
And so we mustn't just purchase these vignette types, the vignette anchors, any more than we must only purchase the anchors, the sort of canopy or the shrub layer or whatever, unless we just want to make a forest. But even in a forest, there used to be, before all hell broke loose environmentally, there used to be a herbaceous layer too down
Yeah, the
below.
deer had white-tailed deer hadn't grazed to enough.
Yeah, exactly. But it's very important to discipline ourselves and think about that matrix layer, not just the pretty faces
It
above.
is the foundation. I mean, of so much of what we're doing. It is. And actually, in our layout process, when we take this kind of quantitative species-rich model to, the field to actually install, I mean, we have what we call kind of an order of operations that breaks the design out into, a series of steps, like, almost like a code, right? I mean, that your programmer might be writing like one script at a time. And so, we start with the matrix oftentimes at following, of course, structure layout before we even get to all the fun stuff, the flowers and all that kind of thing, because we want to make sure that that's hardwired, even just visually during our process, because sometimes it can be easy to, there's many exceptions to that, and there's many good reasons, for not a singular methodology here. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we give that a priority in our thinking, not only in the studio, but also in the field, to say we can't forget to leave space for this. We have to really make sure that there's, we're building the house in such a way that it has, a lot of integrity for a long time.
We have maybe 3 minutes or so, 4 minutes, and I keep thinking each time I talk about this with an expert such as yourself. I think about the first time I visited the University of Wisconsin Madison, and I saw the restored prairie there, and I was, I guess, I was thinking wildflowers. Do you know what I mean? Emphasis on flowers, and to see, as you said earlier, that it might be just down to several species, and a couple of them are grasses, certainly, and to see these essential combinations. And yes, there's going to be these floral moments erupting seasonally, but it's, the anchor, that grounding of the whole community, because it is a community of
That's
plants.
right.
Yes.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, and I mean, I love what you're. That's a landscape that means a lot to me personally. I've been
The
many times.
Curtis Prairie,
Yes, I've been many times over the years, and of course, there's when you start to think at that scale and that spatial level of spatial thinking. And I would say this as a closing thought for anybody out there, regardless of the size of your garden, is, there's something about this that can feel very granular, and like we're putting combinations of certain species together. As you allude to, I think there becomes an almost atmospheric quality when you start to kind of move beyond the threes and the fives stuck together, and you start to think about how some of these patterns, just a handful of these species, start to play out and become kind of, an atmospheric tie that binds, the whole experience of the landscape together. And it creates a different kind of sensation. And that's, I think, what we're always chasing.
You in the time we did the time story, you even pointed out to me that even something, that phenomenon of the desert bloom, the desert super bloom, isn't just, the California poppies we see for miles in front of us, right? It's much more complex than that, isn't it?
Yeah, there's so much more in, you get out there in the field and you think, oh, that's just a field of California poppies, and you end up out in the middle of it and you realize, oh my God, there's four species of lupins, and there's five phacelia, and there's Conactus, and there's just like suddenly all this diversity that's not hiding out there. It's just relatively speaking, our brains are really good at kind of, homogenizing and minimizing the complexity of what we see sometimes. So when you get closer to it, you start to realize, wow, there's an incredible amount of diversity here. And it's a great, for me, it carries into practice as a reminder to say, you can create landscapes that are highly diverse, that have lots of things going on in them, so to speak. And you can get by with it if there are a few of those players that are just kind of everywhere all at once. They're sort of helping to kind of, keep the whole scene cohesive and sensible.
The supporting actors, right? Like a good Broadway show,
That's
right?
right.
It's not just about the lead person.
That's right. It's divas and dancers, right? You got
The
the whole, it's 42nd Street. Everybody marching
chorus, the chorus.
the
Don't forget the
chorus
chorus.
line.
Well, Kelly, I'm always glad to speak to you, and thanks for sharing this. And as I said, we're going to have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com of your natural garden, your most recent book. And I hope I'll speak to you again soon. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening abundantly meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.